Space Cowboy Books presents Simultaneous Times, a science and speculative fiction podcast. Short stories to stir the imagination by contemporary authors.
Golden Triangle by Dane Luscombe. Read by the author, with music by Field Collapse.
Greg kept low behind the abandoned cars, but he knew he was asking for it. The morning sun baked the massive parking lot, turning the asphalt to gum under his boots. It slowed his progress to a crawl. He wore a hat and mirrored sunglasses, but between the blinding sunlight and the stinging sweat pouring from his brow, he could barely see. His reflective poncho kept him from overheating, but it also made him highly conspicuous. He sighed in relief as he finally stepped into the shade of the shopping mall's northern entrance, an old Dillon's department store. Its wall of windows and glass doors had been smashed long ago by some enterprising looter with an 18-wheeler. Unfortunately, the truck had been impaled by a decorative concrete bench and would never move again. The store entrance was now a gaping mouth of concrete, a frozen architectural scream. He cocked his automatic rifle and stepped inside. The department store was a labyrinth of debris, blackened piles of burnt merchandise and emptied display shelves. Plenty of places to stage an ambush. Several mannequins, stripped and crooked, stood at attention. Greg's imagination ran wild. Had he seen one of them move? His reflection followed him in the endless chrome fixtures and shelving. He barely recognized his weathered and sunburnt face. Heaps of flammable synthetic clothing had melted into plastic puddles on the floor. A fire had charred much of the southern wall, making it look like a hellish gateway, and the air smelled dead. He was certain there could be no life here, but a footstep sent several dinner plate-sized huntsman spiders scurrying for cover. The twisted creature sported as many legs as a centipede. He couldn't imagine what animals that large were surviving on. Surely anything edible had been scavenged long ago. Greg had hoped the mall was no longer a viable environment for animal life, but he was clearly mistaken. As he reached an open area, he lowered his rifle and the silence of the empty department store struck his senses. The roof over the cosmetics department had collapsed, flinging ceiling tiles and decaying insulation everywhere. Enough soil and debris had collected beneath the opening that plant life was beginning to colonize the interior of the department store. There was a thick carpet of dark grass that led onto a display of colorful men's shoes. The stack of cardboard boxes underneath had melted in the meager rain and provided enough compost for a small forest glade. Perched atop the grassy knoll were garish sneakers that wouldn't decompose for several centuries. It was an odd, but tranquil scene. The flora was taking full advantage of the periodic filtered sunlight. Outside the shelter of the mall, the sun beat down relentlessly, and most unprotected plant life quickly burned. Life was flourishing in this refuge. A flock of bird-like reptiles had made the caved-in oasis their home and were waiting out the heat of the day. Greg took a moment's rest on one of the cosmetics counter's stools and watched as the dusty air guided bars of sunlight onto the peaceful scene. The reptiles sported a series of scaly wings running down their backs, and their heads ended in horned pincers instead of beaks. Their insectoid compound eyes glittered in the light as they darted around the store. As he left the department store and entered the mall, he noticed some scat on the ground. It was from a carnivore, large enough to be a feral dog or wolf of some kind. It showed only a day or two of age. He drew his weapon and thumbed the safety off. The shattered skylights above the food court lit the dilapidated cavern of what was once the Golden Triangle Shopping Center. Ferocious sunlight flooding this area made Greg feel like he was outside. It was much warmer than it had been in the windowless cave of the department store, and he hung his poncho on a nearby bench and unbuttoned his shirt. Suddenly, the cavernous emptiness of this part of the mall gave him a chill despite the heat. The last time he had set foot in this place, it had been teeming with people. Noise and life had filled the space. Now there was only him and the twisted debris of a forgotten age. He could almost hear the ghosts haunting this place. It felt like an ancient temple. He shrugged the feeling off, and after rounding a bend, finally spotted his destination. The storefront was decorated with futuristic stripes of red and black, and showed little evidence of looting. Its metal security gate was still intact. The electronics store had switched over to almost exclusively selling cell phones before the end days, so it was almost useless in a world without electricity. Luckily, someone had smashed one of the floor-length windows. He dropped his backpack and began to fashion a torch from his fire kit. As Greg leaned back against the brutalist brickwork of the seating area, a noise broke the silence. Water. He had been careless, not realizing the seating area backed up to what was once a large water feature. Over the years, it had become overgrown with plant life, but there was still standing water, probably fed by a shattered skylight or a broken pipe. He rolled forward on the decoratively tiled floor and drew his rifle, but it was too late. He had been ambushed. The creature's tongue harpooned at Greg and enveloped his thigh in a sticky white mass of flesh. Knocked flat on his back, his rifle skidded a good 5 feet across the tile. The animal squirmed into the light, its muscular front legs pulling a large torso with some apparent difficulty. The mouth was wide and frog-like, ringed with hundreds of tiny fangs, and Greg was being dragged towards it in a lurching motion. The tongue cartilage retracted back into the mouth with a heaving power. Greg's hands impulsively went to wrench his trapped thigh free, but the end of the tongue gripped him like a toothed fist, and the sticky mucus stuck one of his hands fast. He was only inches away from the gaping mouth when he remembered the hunting knife sheathed on his calf. He pierced the flesh of the taut tongue, then thrust upwards with the knife. The animal's howl echoed through the entire shopping center. Before the frog creature could retreat into the foliage, Greg pounced and delivered the killing blow. He had made too much noise. He had to move quickly now. He lit his crude torch and held it up to see as far into the dark cave of the electronics store as he could. The sales counter was deep inside the store, past several shelves worth of debris that had been tossed into heaps on the floor. After making it to the counter, he opened his rucksack and grabbed every battery he could find. Large Ds, 9 volts, AAAs, even the large 12-volt bricks. There wasn't much left, but it didn't matter. He had found what he had come for. He filled his bag and ran. He could hear a commotion outside by the creature's carcass. As he burst from the store, he found a hairless, wolf-like creature standing off against another one of the frog mutants. They were tussling over the kill, but both turned to him as he rounded the entrance. He reflexively threw his torch at the wolf, and both animals backed off momentarily, only to begin a steady pursuit. He made for the mall entrance, running backwards with his rifle aloft, firing short bursts at the terrible creatures. As he sprinted through the food court, the sound of gunshots brought the entire mall to life. Terrible, misshapen animal life emerged from every corner. Twisted mutant nightmares had infested the mall and flourished. There were hybrids Greg had never encountered before. A lumbering, muscular beast sporting pale globes for eyes rose from beneath a brightly colored t-shirt kiosk, and Greg narrowly avoided its grasp. A pair of large bipedal deer creatures lunged at him from the doorway of a health food store. Their hooves skittered lithely across the tile, and they seemed unaffected by the hail of bullets he sent their way. He had hit the hairless wolf mutant several times, but it hadn't slowed. As the two deformed deer joined chase, the mutant wolf ferociously attacked one. Greg heard the snared deer howl as the scaly wolf mutant extended what appeared to be tentacles into the animal's throat. Once back in the department store, the train of predators and prey were slowed by the refuse obstructing their path. As Greg hopped a sales counter, the remaining deer mutant leapt and overtook him. Great teeth gnashing inches from his face, Greg closed his eyes and screamed until the deer creature's head jerked backward and he heard the crack of breaking bones. A black mass of tentacles drew the entire animal to the ceiling to devour it. It was a sprawling gelatinous mass several feet wide. Greg had passed beneath the creature only an hour before and was amazed he hadn't suffered the same fate. He scurried to his feet and made for the exit. As he hit the scorching parking lot, his pursuers lost interest. There was obviously enough prey inside the mall to sustain them without having to brave the baking sun. His adrenaline propelled him across the lot in minutes. He kept running until he found the drainage ditch where he had spent the night. Elated to see that nothing had been looted, he crumpled into the old two-man tent. As his panic subsided, he pulled the worn and battered all-in-one DVD player unit from under the bedding and loaded it with the fresh batteries that he had risked everything for. It wasn't late in the day, but the trauma of the last few hours had worn him out. He collapsed onto the musty sleeping bag. With his last ounce of energy, he lifted the screen on the DVD player, powered it on, and pressed play. As his consciousness faded, he smiled as the device's tiny speaker began to produce the first music he had heard in several months. And a voice from another age intoned, "Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise." Greg fell deep asleep and dreamed of other worlds.
All the Little Things by Julie Carpenter. Read by Zara Khan, Dane Luscombe, and Jean-Paul Garnier. With music by the author.
You wouldn't believe the things they don't tell you until your life is mostly over, and it's too late to do anything about it.
Veda took a long pull from her wine glass and stared intently at Daniel through her thick lenses. The boy was studying journalism, or whatever passed for it these days. He was live streaming the interview through a little bumblebee drone hovering over the salt and pepper shakers. The string lights on the cafe patio brightened as darkness fell. Leaning back in her chair, she waved with bejeweled fingers to the waiter for another glass. With the contrived ease of a seasoned storyteller, she began to spin the tale.
"But you didn't ask me here for life advice. Which is good, because I don't have any. You want to hear about Peter, and you shall. But first, not advice, merely an observation. When you're young, you have no idea how many ways there are to lose something. The sudden absences from death add up. There's rejection, on your side or theirs, but more often, the once important people and places of your life will merely fade and be forgotten. A friend you stop calling when you get a new job will have a new baby and stop calling you. You'll move away, and when you return, the corner cafe you went to every morning will be gone forever. And the worst part is, you won't even miss them, because they left you so slowly that you didn't feel them go.
Daniel's expression had gone from strained to utterly desperate as he watched his viewer numbers drop. This chatty old bat was supposed to have some shocking new revelations about one of the century's most notorious pyromaniacs? Should he end the stream and cut his losses?
And so, when a piece from that old history bobs up unchanged 20 years out of its rightful place, you know that something is deeply wrong. It's like a dream when you see the water running uphill. It alerts you that the situation is not what it seems. Do you ever have strange dreams, Danny?
I don't know. Pretty normal, I guess. Is this...
Yes, it is. It's part of the story. It all started with a nightmare. Too many nightmares. As a child, I was afraid to sleep. Most nights, I would leave the TV on low and stay up until I couldn't keep my eyes open. That's why I was awake when the fire swept over the high wall protecting our neighborhood, and I was able to rouse my parents and brother just in time. We piled into our old gas-powered station wagon with our dog and made it to the next town over. We spent 3 weeks camping in the high school gym with our displaced families while the fire reduced our homes to ashes. 3 weeks is forever when you're 7. It was the first of those big losses for me, but in it, I had a small gain. I met a boy around my age, very different from my aloof older brother, and we ran wild on the campus. Building forts, catching bugs, inventing our own languages, we never seemed to run out of ideas. He gave me his mother's phone number when it was time to move on, but when I called him from the sad long-term motel room we were set up with, it was disconnected. It was my second big loss.
Veda paused to swirl the wine in her glass, but set it down without drinking. Danny nodded. He hoped she knew where she was going with this.
Cut to my mid-20s. I was in grad school and needed money. Being a little reckless, I signed up for a pharmaceutical trial. I was in journalism too, like you, and I thought it would make a good story. I'll save you some trouble. It didn't. I just had a weird rash for a month, and then they stopped the trial. However, I ended up going out for drinks with the lead researcher.
Veda laughed preemptively and held up one hand.
The trial was over, totally legal. Don't look at me like that. He got hammered and told me all kinds of things he certainly shouldn't have. Most of it regarded lines of inquiry that had been ended, so perhaps he had cultivated a degree of drunken caution. It was during that whirlwind affair that I scored my first big break. The BBC World Service hired local correspondents in America to cover human interest stories for their socials. I was hired to conduct interviews at the evacuation centers dotting the edges of California fire country. My producer thought my life experience would add poignancy to the reporting. Have you ever been evacuated, Danny?
She tilted her head to the side and waited for a response, as if she were the interviewer.
Yes. Nothing bad really happened.
He shrugged. He didn't like talking about himself.
Looters stole our patio furniture.
You never forget that smell. The moment you get the faintest whiff, you're right back there. That's something I wish I could lose, but I never will. The desire to flee smoke is a primal instinct. It took all of my guts, and not a little medication, to drive towards the flames, but I was determined. After all, that's what I thought success was, taking on greater and greater weight until it either crushed you or made you famous. I drove all over to Sonoma, Ventura County, Orange County, Angeles Crest, San Diego, San Bernardino. Cheap suburbs hastily erected on every viable hillside went up in flames with dull regularity. Many cities kept community centers and high schools set up in the summers for the inevitable refugees.
Several emergency vehicles pulled up to an accident on the street outside the cafe, but the soundproof patio cover shielded the diners. The frosty opaque shield behind Vita sparkled red with flashing lights, reflecting in her mass of silver curls. Daniel felt pleased with the effect on the video.
On my last stop, the evacuation center in Hemet, I got a shock of recognition from so deep it felt like a dream. On the broad lawn near the parking lot, a boy and girl of 7 or 8 were playing a game, shouting nonsense words. But I understood them. I froze in my tracks. My recorder clattered to the sidewalk. The boy turned towards the sound, and we locked eyes. I stared into the face of my first childhood friend. I stepped towards them. He was running off towards the huge crowd in the parking lot. The bewildered girl, left holding one end of a huge tree branch they'd been moving for some unknown purpose, told me the boy's bunk number. I tried to convince myself this was a panic attack, brought on by so many consecutive days, extreme stress, and sleep deprivation. That theory gained ground when I found the bunk in the rec center. The space was occupied by a shaky, pale woman with long dark hair who asserted she was there alone, no children. I went back to my motel and took a sleeping pill.
Veda was a regular. Occasionally another patron would wave to her. A handsome waiter brought her a complimentary dessert.
The next day, it all seemed ridiculous. I drove back to LA, proud of the work I'd done. When I was editing the footage from Ventura, I got another shock. In the background of an interview, again, there was Peter. Blonde curls, olive skin, and a slightly pouty mouth. He was seated cross-legged on a bed with a girl about his own age, not the same one from Hemet, playing a board game.
The elegant old lady's elbows rested on the table, her hands clasped, creating a pyramid above her plate. She wore a very red lipstick that matched her very red eyeglass frames.
When I was little, I had trouble making friends my own age. My brother was much older than me, and I spent a lot of time reading. I didn't know yet how to hide what I knew so that people would like me. Peter was the first kid I met who didn't seem to care, who liked that I wanted to know how the world worked. Of course, I recognized him. You never forget the first time that someone really sees you. Instinctively, I went into investigative mode. I ran a face ID search on Peter's image, but of course there was nothing. Child's face wouldn't be searchable to the public. I had brief footage of the pale woman from the Hemet Rec Center. Her face got a few hits, mostly social media in which she vowed her commitment to various rehabs, one of which was in Ventura, where I'd found the image of Peter. Her last post from Ventura mentioned a new friend that she was planning on traveling with and hinted that this mysterious companion was paying her way. I thought about messaging her, but resisted. I didn't know what was going on, but it didn't feel right and I didn't want to spook her. I searched my own footage for his face, or hers, and got a couple of intriguing partials in the background, but nothing conclusive. Frustrated, I called my doctor boyfriend and asked him to meet me at our usual haunt for a break. I felt like I had both too much and not enough.
She took a bite of her dessert and then pushed it towards Danny. He ignored it and tried to keep her on track.
Does this boyfriend have a name?
She nodded.
He prefers to be left out of the story. I'll call him Dr. Todd. He would absolutely hate it. I halfway expected Dr. Todd to laugh in my face. Instead, he got all quiet and serious. He insisted we head back to my place so he could see the footage. Honestly, it scared me a little. Back at my tiny apartment, I showed him the image. He sent it to his secretary and then stepped out on the balcony to make a quick call. Afterwards, he told me about a class of drugs his company once developed called Timelines. By his tenure, there were already sort of a ghost story the scientists told around the campfire. I'll do my best to explain it as well as he did. First off, there's no such thing as a life extension drug. At least not in the way you're probably thinking. However, you can change the timings that genes turn on and off. The first timeline's drug delayed the onset of menopause. However, it did not extend lifespan or affect non-reproductive markings of aging. Lackluster sales indicated that most women did not wish to extend childbearing into their 70s. Researchers tried altering other genetic timings. They found they could extend life indefinitely, but they could only do it in children before puberty. Until 12 or 13, they could stop growth, then restart it at will. Then, aging would continue normally for the rest of the subject's lifespan. They called the pair of drugs Press Pause and moved forward with human trials. The marketing team was elated, picturing the scenarios they could exploit. Who wouldn't want to give their child a longer life? Just press pause. Want to give your kid more time to learn languages or advanced musical skills? Just press pause. Want to travel the world but don't want Junior to miss out on school? Just press pause. Restart him when you get back. Are you a mommy blogger and want to extend the cuter years for profit? Just press pause.
Danny felt excitement rising in his chest. He'd never heard the drug element of the Peter story. It had been previously reported as some kind of natural mutation.
Most of the participants in the press pause trial turned out fine. Their parents paused them for a year or two and then restarted growth. Unfortunately, in a handful of cases, the reversal dose failed. Those unlucky boys and girls were trapped forever in their child bodies. Although their life experiences continued to accumulate, their brains did not continue the intricate dance of building and severing neural connections to sculpt an adult personality. Thanks to impeccable non-disclosure contracts, the parents received massive sums of money and went home to discreetly live out their lives with their eternal children. Many of them ended tragically, in suicide or murder. Rumor has it some were passed down in families like valuable antiques, as the heirs continued to collect damage payments. Some outlived their parents until meeting with various accidents.
The waiter brought them both coffees. He noticed the waiter's arm was completely smooth up to the elbow. Beautiful skin graft work, Daniel thought. The burn centers worked miracles these days.
A knock at the door interrupted Dr. Todd's history lecture. His nervous lab assistant passed him a folder and scrammed. Glancing at the contents, he showed me a picture of Peter on a medical dossier from a half century before. I paced the room and read it. Peter and his fraternal twin sister Liza were both in the trial. She had started growing again, but he had not. After their parents died in a car accident, Liza took care of him until she died suddenly of an aneurysm in her 30s. After that, Peter disappears, stops coming in for checkups at the company. The company hires detectives to find him, but they are hindered by curfews and travel restrictions imposed after the LA food riots. The last report claims that Peter died in a fire that destroyed a homeless camp in Studio City.
Daniel was bursting with questions, but sensed he didn't have much time. Veda looked exhausted suddenly, and much older. She would want to leave soon.
Did you ever speak to him again? To Peter? After the arrest?
She sadly shook her head.
I wasn't sure at first if Peter had been starting fires or just taking advantage of events to drift through history, recreating his bond with his lost sister with little girls like me. I used my BBC gig as an excuse to request 4 decades of security footage from evacuation centers all over California. I searched for his unchanging face and often found him. Many times he played with a random little girl. It became clear he wasn't a passive bystander. At least, not always. Too many times, he got there first. With Dr. Todd's help, I went to the police with my evidence from the past decade, holding back the part about the drug and replacing it with the story about a genetic disorder. You know the rest. His trial, his conviction, and death at the hands of the angry mob swarming the armored car. Everyone knows someone who's lost everything to fire. There was no safe place for a multiple arsonist, even one in the body of a child. A guard called and asked if I'd like to interview the prisoner awaiting trial. He had no idea about my personal connection to Peter. I had left that out of my report. It was a journalist's dream interview, but I declined. It was too tragic. I couldn't stop imagining him and his sister, during their paused year together, living in a shared dream. What had it been like for her when she was 20 and he was still 8? And then suddenly, she was gone? He must have been unimaginably alone.
Daniel interjected.
So why are you telling this story now?
Veda took a long breath in and looked around the patio. The waiter distributed final coffees to the stylish clientele. These were the most prosperous people of their era, and yet not one of them had ever felt completely safe. She was old enough to remember meeting people who knew that feeling, but they were already old when she was small.
A child is a wonder because it is constantly changing. A child forever is a monster, growing callous to their experiences and yet unable to learn from them. Rage and grief drive such creatures to satisfy their desires by inflicting pain on others. Still, Peter was also a victim. The society that created him was much like an endless child. The world was collapsing around them, and yet all they could do was demand to be cared for, demand to be entertained. Like Peter, they preferred to live in a false bubble of the past, at any cost. I supposed I'd like to remind us not to romanticize that selfish history.
She gave him a smile that suggested the answer was actually much simpler.
Who wouldn't want to stop time, if they could? In the end, Danny, I guess I just didn't want it to be forgotten.
In this episode of Simultaneous Times, you heard Golden Triangle by Dane Luscombe, with music by Field Collapse, and All the Little Things by Julie Carpenter, with music by the author. Theme music by Dane Luscombe. Be sure to check out our online store at bookshop.org/shop/spacecowboybooks. And don't forget to subscribe to Simultaneous Times Podcast. Also, find us on Instagram and Twitter. We'd love to hear what you think of the show.